Hi everyone, we are super excited to welcome you to this second episode of the brand new podcast called The Macro Trading Floor. My name is Andrea Stino.
And I'm Alfonso Peccatiello. Guys, thank you very much for the tremendous support you have given us for the first episode and for the launch. We are actually ranking somewhere like first in Denmark, first in the UK, third in Italy, and top 10 in the US when it comes to investing podcasts on all platforms. I mean, guys, thank you very much for the support. I would like to ask you, in case you want to support us further in this project, to rate us as well on the podcast apps. That would help us a lot. Andreas, by the way, how does the Macro Trading Floor work?
Well, Alfonso, we want to be the most actionable macro podcast in the world. And by that, I mean that we will every week provide a very actionable trade idea, or at least our guests will provide that actionable trade idea. So every week we will make sure that the guests that we invite will end up in a concrete macro trade after exploring their thesis. So this is essentially what it's all about. We want to become concrete in this podcast because that's something we've missed in other podcasts.
And Andreas and I will discuss at the end of the podcast whether we want to buy or we want to sell the idea. No hiding for us as well. We have to stick our neck out to give the example, actually, to our poor guests and to the listeners as well. So guys, you find us on any podcast app, also on Google Podcasts. If you guys complained that we weren't there yet, we fixed that for you. And also on the Blockworks Macro YouTube channel, in case you want to go and check that out, you can subscribe there as well to receive updates and you don't miss any new episodes. But Andreas, I heard that the listeners gave us some pretty fun feedback. Do you want to enlighten us on that?
Well, especially on YouTube, a lot of listeners, they noticed this picture in my background. Sorry to the audio listeners only here. But yes, this is a fake Bansi poster. And I saw someone writing that since this was not the original painting from Bansi, then he rather not wanted to follow my recommendation since I didn't have the money to buy the original. So fair enough. I take that as fair feedback. This is a fake poster actually shipped from China as far as I remember. So fair feedback. I have to admit that. And I think this is a reminder that we're going to have some fun in this podcast and we're also able to laugh about ourselves. So every week, Alfonso, we try to come up with the worst take we've seen in the world of finance over the past 7 days. And as per usual, I've seen almost a truckload of candidates for the worst take of the week. But I actually want to direct my worst take of the week towards Cathie Woods, the founder of the ARKK ETF. The ARKK investment material was updated over the past week. So they also updated their projections for some of the stocks in the portfolio, including Tesla. And from the new projections on the share price, I see that the bear case for Cathie Woods is a share price of roughly $3,000 for Tesla. I think that's around three times the price. Yeah, that's around three times the price of today. And the upside case is even more material than three times the current stock price. And they based this on what they call a Monte Carlo study. And for those of you who don't know what a Monte Carlo study is, it's basically a computer simulation on scenarios. So they've probably feeded in some scenarios for future growth in Tesla. And then they came up with these three scenarios in which the bear case was a three doubling of the current share price in Tesla. I find that a bit amusing. And I also find it, to be honest, slightly cocky to have a base case of a tripling of the current share price. At least I wouldn't have the guts to say that the base case was a three doubling. I mean, it sounds so smart to have a Monte Carlo model, but basically if you feed the Monte Carlo model with shit, you get shit out, right? So, I mean, essentially you cannot trust the Monte Carlo model unless the assumptions are smart. That's what I wanted to clarify.
I mean, and my worst take of the week moves all the way east, goes to Japan. And, you know, I've been reading recently that the bond markets are testing and will break the Bank of Japan. And I'm like, all right, so let's see how this works. So the Bank of Japan has at the moment the yield curve control with a cap at 25 basis points for the 10-year Japanese government bonds. Trust me, guys, you can't break that because there is a big difference. The Bank of Japan has potentially an unlimited balance sheet, can expand, while the private sector doesn't have an unlimited balance sheet or warehousing power risk to try and challenge that. So the only entity in Japan that can break the 25 basis point yield cap is the Bank of Japan themselves, if they decide not to defend that anymore, because on the FX side, maybe they have some, they start having some weakening issues that are pretty large, but it's not the private sector. It's not traders. They can't break the Bank of Japan on a domestic currency denominated government bond, because the Bank of Japan simply has a potentially fully elastic balance sheet the private sector doesn't have.
So you wouldn't even count on George Soros breaking this yield curve control mechanism?
in principle, no. The Bank of Japan can just defend the 25 basis points for as long as they want. But, you know, it sells. It sounds very impressive that the bond market is about to break Bank of Japan there. But, you know, the only one that can break the Bank of Japan is the Bank of Japan itself. Now, enough with the banter and the takes of the week. Let's talk about markets for a second.
Yes.
So I know, Andreas, that you have been pretty interested in exploring some of the second round effects of these supply chain disruptions we are seeing as the result of the Chinese lockdown. So help us a bit think through asset classes when it comes to these second round effects.
I received a live map of ships queuing up outside of the Shanghai port by connection within shipping. And it's essentially one of the worst pictures I've ever seen. So the queue outside of Shanghai is just massive right now as a consequence of what I would call the super lockdown in Shanghai. As far as I can see, people are not even allowed to leave home unless it's very, very necessary, at least. So therefore, we may have what I will call the mother of all supply chain issues right in front of us, since Shanghai is one of the most important ports worldwide. I know you live close to Rotterdam, another important port. And then we have a couple of ports in the southwest of the US being very important for global supply chains. But for goods moving from east to west, then Shanghai is probably the most important port. So when there is a queue there, it matters, in particular for the price of goods and maybe also consumer discretionary such as iPhones. So this is something that you will need to be on the watch for over the next 6-8 weeks, because if ships are not able to leave Shanghai with the goods, then obviously it comes with a repercussion for the pricing and even also for, simply speaking, the supply in US stores. So I wouldn't be too surprised to see a scarcity of plastic shit in Walmart within a few weeks from now, because that's essentially the side effect of what's going on in Shanghai right now. And therefore, it also becomes important for the Federal Reserve, because we've seen how the price of goods has increased quite materially in the US. That's in sharp contrast to the Eurozone, by the way. But if the price of goods increases even more, then I think stakes are raised for the Federal Reserve this summer. We already see how they debate this internally. And therefore, Alf, I wanted to ask you whether you trust the guidance from Jim Bullard from the Federal Reserve. Oh. He hinted of 75 basis points worth of hikes at the next meeting.
My good old friend, Jim Bullard. So he was the guy who started the rumor on 50 basis points. Actually, he's going to get it. So in credit to Jim Bullard. And now he starts a new one. It's 75 basis points. It's notorious to all macro investors that if ships are not leaving Shanghai, then in order to fight that basically supply constrained good inflation, you're going to raise rates, right? By 75 basis points. That's going to make ships move from the Shanghai port. No, I'm just kidding. But Bullard went out with a provocation of hiking 75 basis points. He called that not his base case. The front end of the Eurodollar future market hasn't really reacted to that. So we have a 50 basis point full price in for May, another 50 basis point for June. So 100 basis point in basically 2 months ahead of us. The chance of 75 basis point is only marginally priced. That, I think, looking at my screen, is 15% as we speak. It's April 20th, 2022, by the way. What's interesting in the bond market, Andreas, is that the back end of the bond market is moving now too. So 30-year bond yields went to 3% What's happening is that the front end is still pricing in a terminal rate of around about 3%, very front loaded. All in the next 12 to 15 months, we're going to have a massive 275 basis point additional hikes by the Federal Reserve. But interestingly, while a month ago, forward curves were then flattening in very rapidly and pricing in a long-term neutral rate of around about 2% in the US, now this coming back, let's say from 3% terminal rate back to a nominal rate, is a much more shallow path than before. And the neutral rate has been repriced a bit higher, somewhere in the 2.5 to 75% area. This is probably due to markets now trying and chase whether the economy and risk assets can actually take a higher nominal neutral rate. So where is the pain point basically for the private sector and for risk assets when it comes to also long end nominal and real yields repricing higher? How much can the private sector take? It's very similar, I think, to September 2018, where also the long end of the bond market was approaching 3.25% and trying to push further and further and further to see what was the neutral rate the private sector and risk assets could take. Back then it was around about 3.25%.
Yeah, and maybe it will be a tad lower this time around. That would be my guess. But
yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, compared to 2018, we have worse demographics. We have a labor force which has shrunk, both because of aging and because of, well, the great resignation, if we want to call it like that. But in general, people abandoning the labor force. So we have a smaller labor force than then. In terms of productivity trends, there haven't been major changes. And in terms of unproductive debt loads in the economy, we have actually gone up both in the private and in the public sector because of the pandemic borrowing to fill income gaps caused by the lockdowns. I honestly can't see equilibrium rates being higher than they were in 2018. But watch out, guys. That doesn't mean that temporarily nominal yields can't trade above a perceived equilibrium level. They can, because that is effectively what the Fed wants. They want to slow down the economy. And to do that, you make things tight for the private sector, right?
Yeah, but I think it's interesting how the labor force developed through COVID. Essentially, the boomers aren't returning. I think that's what we're seeing. That's why participation rates are lower. So I guess boomers, they want to work from the Amalfi Coast just as well as you want to. Yeah. But I also accuse you of being a boomer from time to time. So
yes, I mean, I'm bold like most of the boomers out there, but I don't own three or four houses, so I should catch up there. With the mortgage rates going where they're going, I don't think I'm going to be able to catch up anywhere soon. The other interesting development I wanted to ask you about is in Japan before we introduce our new guest. And so, well, the Japanese yen has been suffering pretty aggressively, and we all know that Japan is an energy importing nation. So that doesn't help the JPY here, but the monetary policy divergence seems to be explaining most of the move. Do you have a take on the Japanese yen here?
I think it will continue to be the weakest link within the big currencies. And the reason is that I see no signs that Bank of Japan is willing to give up on the yield curve control. We saw another massive weakening move in the Japanese yen this week when the Bank of Japan announced a market operation to continue to support the 10-year point on the yield curve. And until we get inflation breaking substantially above target in Japan, I suspect that they will continue down this path. And while every other central bank globally is moving in the other direction, Bank of Japan seems stuck in the mess. And that's essentially why the market reacts by weakening the Japanese yen. At some point, of course, we will probably see imported inflation to Japan if the Japanese yen weakens enough. But maybe that is exactly what the Bank of Japan is after here. So it might even be a deliberate weakening of the Japanese yen.
Yeah, actually, if I had a look at Japanese inflation expectation, and even with this sharp weakening of the yen, which might wanna, you know, move some inflation being imported in Japan, 5-year inflation swaps in Japan are traded below 1%. I mean, that's not scary at all for a country has been trying very hard to get some inflation in. So an orderly depreciation of the Japanese yen might actually be a voluntary tactic here. Truth to be said, the move we have seen over the last month is all but orderly, to be honest. And probably the energy price moves are driving some of this additional weakening and the sharp move we have seen.
Yeah. And I mean, you find two countries within the G10 that are extremely reliant on importing energy. The first one is Japan. The second one is Germany. So those two countries, they are stuck in a mess due to the current moves that we see in energy space. And that is exactly the theme that our guest, Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy, wants to take us through today. And she has a trade idea, I know, related to the whole narrative on rising energy prices. So we look forward to that.
Hey, Lynn, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. For the few people, I should say by now, that don't know who you are or how did you got into finance, do you want to give us a short overview?
Sure. So my background is engineering, and then I went into engineering management and running the finances for an engineering facility. But on the same time, I always had an interest in finance investing. I actually started doing that before I was an engineer. And so after a while of doing that other job, I eventually kind of transitioned back and I decided to start a research firm in 2016. And so I've been doing that ever since and focusing on basically providing research for both retail and institutional clients. So, you know, kind of the sweet spot that I go for is to kind of do, you know, kind of institutional type of research, but in plain English. So it's something that you know, it's not these like highly sophisticated structured trades, but it's also stuff that's relevant for them, but then it's explained in plain English. So the audience base is kind of from sophisticated retail up through institutional.
And your plain English doesn't even have an Italian or a Danish accent. So that's pretty good. Well done.
So let's get to it, Lynn. If we look at your current macro thesis, then I guess it is impossible not to look at supply chains globally at the moment. Alfonso and I had a quick chat about it in the intro of the podcast. We see a worsening of the situation in the port of Shanghai. So the supply chain basically keeps being distressed by various developments across the globe. How does that link to your current macro thesis?
Yeah, so I definitely want to avoid things that are vulnerable to the supply chain. And of course, that's somewhat impossible. I mean, it kind of spreads out to everything, but you want to avoid things that are kind of directly hurt by it. And so, you know, prior to a couple months ago, you know, supply chains are already disrupted. Then we throw in war into the mix. And then we also throw in, you know, extreme lockdowns in China. And so that was kind of a 1-2 punch to an already stressed system. And so we have all these supply side problems in energy markets, commodity markets, and then supply, you know, infrastructure, logistics. And so that's the supply side. Then the demand side of the macro situation is that we have, you know, stimulus being withdrawn. You know, so there's, you know, few countries doing fiscal anymore, and they're tightening monetary policy. And so you have kind of a softening demand, but you still have very tight supply side. And so that whole kind of inflation, disinflation structure is kind of messy at the moment. And so my general position macro view is overall defensive without being necessarily disinflationary.
I think that makes a ton of sense, Lynn, to position in a defensive fashion into this environment. I wanted to also talk to you about the underlying reason why we see inflation now, because I actually noted that you were one of the first commentators out there to pinpoint the move that we saw towards fiscal stimulus throughout COVID and how that basically changed the inflation picture. Can you briefly run us through why that is?
Yeah, so basically, if you look at a lot of people associate inflation with QE, right? Yeah. So quantitative easing. But the issue there is that, you know, if you create bank reserves, it just stays in the banking system and the financial system, doesn't really get out to the public, right? So if the Fed buys $1 trillion of bonds, my bank account doesn't get any bigger, right? So I can't go and buy more things. Whereas if they send me checks or if they give me tax cuts that are unfunded by anything, if they do very stimulus, if they give me a PPP loan and then they say, you know, you don't have to pay it. It's you know, we make that a grant now. Well, then I can go out and buy more things, right? And so that's kind of what happened in the United States and a number of other countries where in addition to QE, so QE was you know, it was funding some of it. It was buying some of the bonds, but there was a transmission mechanism where the fiscal authority would just, you know, give money to people. And so you had, unlike, say, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, you had an increase in the balance sheet, the Federal Reserve balance sheet, but you did not have a spike in broad money supply. Whereas this time, you had an actual spike in broad money supply. People had more money in their bank accounts. And I mean, that's not purely retail money, but there's a big chunk of that that was retail money. And so people had more money to spend. So when you radically increase the money supply, you're prone to eventually get inflation unless you have no supply constraints anywhere. Right. And so the combination of more money units in the system and therefore more demand, combined with the fact that we've underinvested in supply chains, we've underinvested in shipping, we underinvested in many commodity production and transporting. And so you have that combination that looks, you know, you get, it's similar to inflationary periods in the past, 2000s decade, the 1970s decade, and the 1940s decade. And specifically going back in the history books, the 1940s decade was instructive to me because that's the last time, you know, the U.S. In particular had very fiscal driven inflation rather than, say, bank lending driven inflation.
Yeah, it's a great summary, Lynn. And the fact that this bank deposits basically increased, especially the bank deposits not sitting in the financial system, but really retail bank deposits, if we wish, increased, while supply was also tight at the same time. It's quite an inflationary cocktail. And that's what we're seeing happening right now. But you also talked about demand now being weakening because this impulse of increased spendable bank deposits because of fiscal deficits has effectively, slowed down pretty aggressively. And bank lending is subsidizing some of it, but to a certain extent only. So how does a weakening demand interplays into your macro thesis?
So I think it takes some of the edge off the inflation trade, right? So I don't think it'll necessarily keep going up at the same rate that it was. As I previously described, you know, in kind of my other, you know, writings and podcasts and things like that, in the 40s and the 70s, you had disinflationary periods within overall inflationary decades. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the 2020s be the same way, where I think this is going to be a fairly inflationary decade, but that there's going to be counter trends. There's going to be periods where central banks fight back. There's going to be periods where fiscal authorities are not giving out money. And so that takes some of the edge off of the demand side and kind of transitions it from, say, a reflationary environment to a stagflationary type of environment where you still have constraints on the supply side. Some of them are even getting worse. But the demand side softer. And so I think that can manifest more so in shortages than just prices keep going up because people just don't have the money to buy some discretionary goods. If you know, they have to kind of prioritize the essentials. And so that's kind of relating to defensive positioning, because if you have high inflation, but you also have growth, you can go into more risk assets. Whereas if you have, you still have supply issues, but that demand side is going down, then you want to be careful about some of the more kind of retail, you know, consumer type of discretionary products and services.
Very interesting. So you're basically describing a pendulum, basically, where we are moving towards a structurally more inflationary decade, but there will be pendulum swings between even more inflationary trends and rather stagflationary trends where economic growth slows down. A lot of the macro discussion, Lynn, is focused on inflation. I want to get your take on real growth, potential real growth going forward. So how do you see the 2020s playing out basically from a growth perspective?
I see it as not being particularly high in inflation adjusted terms. And, you know, this next year in particular, we have declining PMI, we have very low consumer sentiment. Europe's facing an acute energy issue. China's had these extreme lockdowns. Russia's impacted by all of the sanctions. And so, you know, there are spots of growth around, right? But it's a very challenging environment overall. And while commodities and energy and things like that are scarce, it's hard to get a lot of abundant growth, right? It's kind of a pressure that makes it hard to grow from. And so I think that this will be a decent decade for nominal growth, but I think a big chunk of that will be inflationary and that real growth will be tricky to come by. Now, it's possible that by the end of the decade, if some of these release valves kind of get pushed or not, you could have kind of a mini boom. But I think that until some of those structural changes happen, I don't see this as being a very good environment for real growth.
We know that we have the midterms upcoming later this year. How important do you see the midterms for the growth outlook over the next 6-9 months?
I think because they're already kind of gridlocked, there's not really a lot happening now and then probably not kind of happen after midterms, right? Because they'll still be gridlocked, arguably more gridlocked, at least unless polls are way off. I think some of the actions are to try to go, you know, kind of at least tame inflation prior to the midterms, right? So, for example, drawing down the strategic petroleum reserve I think that's somewhat of a midterm play. So I think that, around the margins, it's a factor. But I think that overall, the fact that they're already basically in gridlock, does, you know, that's kind of already the case. So I think that it's hard for the, say, the executive branch to unilaterally do a lot to spur growth in the next several months. And so I think that the kind of declining PMIs, the supply chain issues, are going to kind of take precedent, and therefore I view it as a you know, more defensive type of environment.
If I look at the development right now in the macro data in the US, I've actually seen quite a few positive surprises over the past month. If we look at the Atlanta Now GDP measure, it bounced from roughly 0% to 2.5%, I think, in a matter of weeks. What do you make of the recent trends that we've seen in US data? Will they continue to surprise on the upside over the course of the early summer?
That's something, admittedly, I don't know. I don't have a high conviction view on that. I'm not basically calling for any sort of high conviction recession, right? So I'm not saying it's going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. It might. I mean, it depends on what happens with supply chains and things like that. I mean, you could certainly force a recession. I just kind of view it as soft, right? So I think that we're bouncing from GDP now, if I looking at it from kind of just my mental picture, I don't have it in front of me, but it went like zero roughly, or even sub-zero, and then it bounced to something like 1.5, you know, it kind of bouncing to a low number. It's still a low number. It's just less bad than it was. And we've kind of seen that manifested in some of the stock, right? So you kind of had a little bit of response in some risk assets. And so I'm not super bearish on risk assets. I just have a tilt towards being defensive and trying to find things that, you know, will work even in a supply side constrained environment, and then will work whether or not we have slow growth, medium growth, you know, no growth. So kind of trying to do damage control either way.
That makes a lot of sense. The elephant in the room we haven't talked about yet is monetary policy. So we've discussed fiscal policy, the demand side, the supply side, but what about monetary policy here? So the Federal Reserve is basically promising to hike above neutral rates, Lynn, whatever neutral rates are, nobody knows, but the signal is becoming pretty hawkish, and QT is around the corner too. So how does that interplay with your macro thesis?
So I think that adds to the defensive thesis, especially the lack of quantitative easing and the potential beginning of quantitative tightening. That makes it a little bit more tricky for asset prices to keep growing. That doesn't mean it's impossible. I mean, there are periods where asset prices can go up quite a bit. But I think that given the other factors, declining PMI environment and tightening policy, there's kind of, if you run kind of a back test on that scenario, it's pretty poor for asset prices. And so a lot of that's already been kind of priced in, right? So the market's already front run the Fed, you know, for the most part, and other central banks. I'm not sure they're going to be able to get as tight as they are saying that they're going to get. I think they're going to try to tighten until something kind of forces them otherwise, right? So until, you know, credit markets get illiquid, treasury market gets illiquid, or a recession indicator start to you know, kind of pound them, I think they're going to try to tighten. And so I think that that's kind of a choppy environment, a challenging environment for a lot of asset prices. But I think a lot of that's, you know, it's going to come down to whether or not they end up tightening more than the market expects or less than the market expects, because the market already has anticipated a certain amount of tightening. And so basically what's hard is that they're tightening later than they normally would have, right? So kind of like how in late 2018, they had already been tightening for a while, but then growth started to slow down. And so that's when they ran into a problem, when they were going about autopilot tightening at a time when you had just economic growth rolling over. And so eventually had illiquid credit markets, and they had to turn, you know, kind of turn around, do the famous Powell pivot. And so I think that they're kind of in a similar situation. It's obviously a little different, but I think that they're in a similar type of environment where they're trying to tighten into a slowdown. And I think it's going to get messy at some point. I just don't know exactly where that mess is going to show up. I mean, I think there's kind of self-feedback loop where if they tighten too much, they strengthen the dollar, they increase hedging costs, foreign sector doesn't buy as many treasuries, banks are already stuffed full of treasuries, right? They've been huge buyers of treasuries. And if they then start to do quantitative tightening, they start to let maturities roll off, that kind of squeezes the treasury market. It could get a little bit of liquid. And so, I'm not sure how long or how far they're going to go with the tightening. I'm going to kind of take the under, even though I don't exactly know how high rates are going to get, how much they're going to be able to shrink their balance sheet. I think it's, you know, sooner rather than later is when they run into an issue.
If I understand correctly, where you lie on your base case macro thesis is that we are going to be facing still some inflationary pressures, although maybe slightly declining, but still there, pretty aggressive inflationary pressures at a point where PMIs are slowing down and monetary policy tightening will compound this growth slowdown. So in this cyclical environment, Lynn, what are the asset classes you look at for places where to hide? There are not many. If you look at year-to-date returns, they're pretty bleak across the board.
Generally, I like a combination of energy producers, energy transporters, healthcare stocks, gold, cash equivalents, kind of the middle of the curve, maybe 2-year treasuries, things like that. And then I do have some barbell, like, you know, I have Latin American equities, I have Bitcoin, I have, you know, a small number of kind of these network effect growth stocks, right? Very small positions. So I have some of a barbell going on, but I'm kind of oriented, weighted towards kind of defensive value in ones that are not heavily tied in the supply chain and basically some, you know, liquidity in order to rebalance into any sort of, you know, downturns
and
you might have.
Lynn, what are the signs that you would be on the watch for to turn around on that thesis?
One would be basically improving rate of growth metrics, right? So, you know, maybe an opening of China. We're starting to maybe see that some of these extreme lockdowns are easing. They might have already hit peak lockdown, and that they're maybe slowly coming out of that peak level of lockdown. But I think that could also potentially exacerbate inflation, because that means more demand could be opening up. If China kind of starts stimulating a little bit, that could actually impact inflation. And so really it's kind of watching for changes in the growth itself. And so I think I would look at signs of how much banks are lending, and things like that. And that's why I'm not completely devoid of risk. I think, you know, I would kind of balance it based on what's happening. And then right now, you know, until I see evidence to the contrary, I like that somewhat defensive positioning, but it's not like a super bear, like, you know, hardcore bear, don't own anything that's risky type of a portfolio. It's just a waiting.
I had a discussion with Michael Guyette earlier this week on whether it makes sense at all at any time, a point in time in history, to be cash loaded as a private investor. My answer is no. Do you have a view on that, Lynn? Does it make sense to be cash loaded at any point?
I think probably not. I think there are times to have a little bit more cash equivalents than others, you know, basically a little bit more rebalancing fuel. You'd have to have a pretty high conviction view on both direction and timing in order to have a lot of cash, right? So, you know, maybe if you were, for example, one of the people watching the subprime mortgage crisis and had a high conviction it was going to blow up in the next year or two, you know, having a lot of cash would be useful there. But other than that, I think that generally cash is kind of designed to lose value over time. And I often joke that it's kind of the one speculative asset I own, because it's the one thing I own that I know is going to get worth less over time, but that I still own some based on the speculation that some of the things I actually want to own might get cheaper, and that I might be able to rebalance into that. And so it's all about a percentage in my view. Now, you know, if a trader, it's obviously also different between a trader and an investor. If someone's a trader, you know, they can go to a complete cash position until they kind of realign what they're looking for. Whereas if you're actually just a long-term investor, I think that there are, you know, there's no reason to ever be 100% cash or massively cash.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Actually, cash, you can see that as a relatively expensive optionality from a real rate perspective. So
exactly,
inflation
yeah.
keeps on eating you away, and the time value of that also compounds against you. So it's a relatively expensive optionality, but owning some of it depends from your risk tolerance. 100% cash is, you know, quite an interesting position. I should agree with you guys there. But Lynn, I mean, we talked about plenty of stuff, pretty short and sweet so far, but in every macro trading floor episode, we're going to ask our guests to be clear about what's the macro trade. So here is the question. What's your macro trade?
Yeah, so I like energy pipelines here. And the reason is I like them on multiple timeframes. So there are a number of things I like long-term that I have no idea what's going to happen in 6 months. Let's say Bitcoin, right? So it's got a mild uptrend, but I don't know what's going to happen in the next 6 months, even though I like it for 5 years. But in a declining PMI environment with supply chain issues and kind of the stagflationary type situation, I want something that I like for the next 5 years, but that I also, you know, I think has a reasonable prospects over the next 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And so, you know, we've had a big run-up in energy producers. I still don't think they're expensive. But energy pipelines have kind of lagged. And they have less overall sensitivity to oil prices. They still have some sensitivity because it can affect the, you know, producer volumes, and therefore it can affect their volumes. And you, in the past, you had pipeline companies blow up when you had energy price crashes. It's because they were over-levered, mm-hmm. right? So they were reliant on constantly issuing debt, constantly issuing equity. And so even if their underlying business was not impacted too much, their whole financing model was. It was basically reliant on unlimited capital being able to, you know, being willing to buy all of their types of liabilities. And so in the past several years, you've had now two blowups in the energy, U.S. energy pipeline space. The first one was back in the whole 2015-2016 period. And then you had another one during COVID that kind of took out some of the stragglers. And so now that the dust kind of cleared, I actually really like that space. I think it's more appropriately levered given the, you know, it's still an asset heavy business, kind of utility like. So they have some leverage, but it's now back down to very reasonable levels. And I think that they're kind of well positioned here. Their valuations are totally reset. And there's a couple ways to play it. One is you can focus on the really high quality names. So for example, I like Energy Products Partners. EPD is the ticker. And they're one of the ones that never blew up, right? So they never had to cut their distribution. They never got over-levered. Whenever these slowdowns would happen, they just would kind of stagnate for a couple years and then resume growing. So they'd run into headwinds, but they wouldn't blow up. Basically very well managed, very diversified. So it's not just oil, right? It's oil, it's natural gas, it's natural gas liquids, it's petrochemicals, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of different types of energy and refined products, transporting and storing and exporting. And so with, say, Europe's energy system crippled at the moment, and basically still a long-term prospect for emerging market energy demand growth, I think that basically the U.S. is well positioned in terms of energy production and then particularly energy transport. And so I like that space quite a bit. And you can also play it with the ETF for the space, which is AMLP. So one of the downsides of pipelines is that a lot of them still are structured as partnerships. And so they issue a K-1 form, basically at tax season. It gets a little bit complicated. That actually keeps a lot of fast money out of it. It keeps kind of the valuations a little bit lower, a little bit more frictions, which is really good if you're a multi-year investor. You get higher distributions, you get better compounding. But if you want to get in for 9 months and then out, then something like the ETF could be a better way to play it.
If we look at the flip side of this trade, Lynn, what would be the warning signals to get out of the trade?
The reason I picked it is because it's hard to envision a scenario where it just completely falls out of bed. The uptrend that's been in place since the bottom of COVID could certainly kind of roll over if you had kind of a deteriorating U.S. energy production, right? So we see, for example, many energy producers are not investing heavily in CapEx, and you have kind of bottlenecks in terms of allowing new pipelines to be built. And so you could get stagnation in the space, and therefore you might not perform terribly, but you might, for example, underperform the S&P 500, which would be a shame. And so I can certainly envision a number of scenarios that impact it that lead to underperformance. But I think a lot of the crash risk has been removed from that space. Another thing that we're watching is how they're kind of responding. So, for example, in prior years, they used to issue a lot of equity and they used to be building a lot of pipelines rapidly. Now they've transitioned towards a more self-financing model. So they have lower distribution yields. And some of them are actually ironically buying back their own units. Right, so they're not even issuing new units. Some of them are actually mildly shrinking their unit count, and so now you're basically expecting slower growth, but you're still expecting decent per unit or per share performance, right? So they've rearranged where their expected returns are coming from. So a little bit higher yields due to lower valuations, and then kind of low unit growth or even no unit growth, maybe unit shrinkage, and then kind of very slow increases from inflation and other things like that they can, you know, pass on price increases. So I think it's really one of those things where most of your returns are going to come from distributions over time if you hold it long term. If you hold it short term, you have that kind of that mild uptrend in place. I think there's a decent chance on the downside that it just ends up being kind of an underwhelming trade where it doesn't really go anywhere. It's kind of dead money.
And on the upside, Lynn, what targets do you expect this trade to be able to reach over a few quarters down the road, which is your time horizon, if I understand correctly?
So I think EPD could get over 30 and you know, trend towards the mid-30s. And I think AMLP, the ETF, I think could trend towards the mid-40s or up to 50 or so. But that's, you know, you're kind of basing it on investor psychology. What are they going to want to pay for it? You know, so I think that they are worth those numbers now. But the question is, what will the market pay for it? And so if you have a broad market downturn, you know, you might not hit those targets. You might just chop along. You might hold up better than the market, but you might not reach those. I think the best thing about the trade is that, you know, it should be decent over, say, a 9-month period, the rest of this year. But it's also just a good 3 to 5 year position if you want to let it run past that. And so you can kind of choose your own time frame, whether you're a trader or an investor.
Lynn, this was a very compelling macro thesis and also a very good trade. I have to admit that I like it a lot personally. So that's really good. If our listeners want to follow more of your thoughts, where can they find you online?
I'm at lynnalden.com. I have a free newsletter people can sign up for. I'm also on Twitter at lynnaldencontact. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lynn, for being here with us. Ciao.
So, Alfonso, this was basically another long energy trade that Lynn Alden very compellingly went through. So let's first of all have a look at the thesis behind her trade. She talked about energy resources being in scarce supply. I have to agree with that. But then she also talked about the demand picture falling apart slowly but surely. That was something I noted as well. And I guess that speaks a little bit against being long energy, at least historically. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's actually a delicate balance. So with commodities, it's very difficult to model, actually, because you'll have to look at the two sides of the equation and only at one side. And my indicators have been screaming that the demand side has been weakening since summer last year when it comes to the impulse of growth, actually. But that doesn't mean commodities can't rally. If you make the supply extremely tight, even if demand is coming down, well, the real question here is how much is priced in when it comes to, you know, future bottlenecks and future demand drop. And that's very difficult to measure. If you look at the backwardation of these commodity curves, traders seem to suggest that actually some of this is already priced in. Spot prices are much higher than already 1 year backdated future prices in oil, so, or other commodities. So overall, it's quite a difficult call here. And I think her analysis is balanced and she's looking at one expression of the energy trade, which act, right? It's correlated to energy, but not one-on-one. The correlation is rather 0.5, 0.6, which means there are other factors in her trade that might actually work. What do you make of the, let's say, the choice of the ETF she discussed?
Well, she picked the ETF called AMLP. And when I look at the holdings, first of all, we have 15 companies beneath the surface of the ETF, all linked to pipelines and transportation of energy. So this is not just a straightforward oil trade. It is also a trade linked to political decisions on future supply, first of all, of oil and natural gas, because natural gas is also an important part of the pipeline building. And to be very honest, if you've asked me like 2 or 3 years ago about this trade, then I would probably have told you to stay as far away as you could. But right now, I'm a bit more in doubt because, I mean, even politicians like Joe Biden, who basically opposed exploiting oil just 18 months ago, it's slowly but surely turning on that view. We even see the German politicians starting to debate other energy sources. So this is a completely different environment for this trade compared to a couple of years ago. And when you look at the sort of capabilities of this ETF, then it's a high yielding ETF from a dividend perspective. So it actually pays dividend, which is, I guess, a decent quality in the current environment. We've at least seen how non-dividend paying stocks have suffered as a consequence of the higher interest rates that we've seen across the board. So this is what I will call to a certain extent a value trade, even though it's energy linked. Therefore, it sort of plays into the overall narrative that value stocks will perform versus growth stocks. And if we look at the performance year to date, this AMLP ETF is up 24.25%. So quite a performance in this environment. You won't find a lot of assets going up more currently. So I think some of the capabilities are pretty decent. What I dislike about it from our portfolio's perspective is that it's very linked to the trade that we discussed last week with our guest, James Leitner. So maybe we should take an update on that trade, because we debated the idea of going long Brazil with Jim. What's the update on that front, Alf?
So Jim Leitner was our first inaugural guest, and he proposed to be long Brazilian real and short the dollar. And for people who couldn't replicate the trade on an FX account, then there were some proxy expressions that could be, for example, being long an MSCI Brazil ETF tracker and try to short some S&P tracker against it. So effectively trying to replicate the trade, but in the equity space, perhaps. Some listeners have suggested that one other way to do this without taking equity risk premium could be to buy Brazilian bonds. If you have access somehow through your brokers to Brazilian bonds, you replicate the Brazilian currency exposure and take bond risk on top, which is much less beta intensive and volatility intensive than equity risk. I think it's a smart suggestion. Thank you, listeners, from that perspective. The reality is that the Brazilian real long entered by Jim was at 4.7 Brazilian real against the dollar. And today it's trading at 4.63. So the Brazilian real has been appreciating against the dollar, which goes well for the trade. Interestingly, if you look at proxies, Andreas, they are not performing. So Brazilian equities have underperformed the S&P, even after adjustment for the currency appreciation of the Brazilian real, which goes to show how proxy trades can be dangerous because they incorporate other factors that are outside basically the initial very core macro trade idea. But as always, we're going to try and give away proxies that are as close as possible to the original trade to make it actionable for our listeners out there.
Ultimately, we need to highlight that Jim so far had his trade spot on, even though it was a trade already performing when he suggested the trade in this podcast. The performance continued over the past week in the Brazilian real, and we should remember, on top of the spot development that you just showcased, there is also a running yield of being long the Brazilian real versus the dollar from the yield spread. So if you do this on a foreign exchange account, you will simply get a deposit rate denominated in Brazilian real with a yield. And that yield is much, much higher than the yield you will get on equivalent dollar accounts. I think it's even a double-digit spread in percentage terms. So as long as the spot development is just flat, then this is a very decent trade. So I essentially stick to the view from last week that the trade seems to work.
As my mentor used to say, the hot shower of carry, Andreas. That's the hot shower of carry. Just kidding. But the AMLP suggested by Lynn, actually, we decided not to basically onboard that in our portfolio of trades from Andreas and my side, simply because the correlation with the existing trade we have onboarded from Jim last week is relatively high. It's 0.6, with the Brazilian real being a commodity exporter, that's not the news, and being a value emerging market country, also that is not the news. So instead of piling up on the same correlation, despite the trade might have merits, as Andreas has discussed before, we have decided not to onboard on the trade. Nevertheless, I find Lynn's macro explanation behind how our next decade and next months as well and few years might unfold to be a pretty interesting one. So before we say goodbye, Andreas, I want to discuss a few minutes with you about Lynn's take. So she basically split two angles behind nominal growth in inflation and real growth going forward. She basically believes that inflation is going to be structurally higher than it was in the previous decade, although there are going to be pendulum swings between, you know, really high inflation environment and, you know, inflation slowing down a bit together with growth, what she called stagflationary cyclical environments. But she also discussed real growth being pretty modest going forward over the next decade. Do you agree with this take?
I tend to agree that we've entered a higher inflationary regime. But what I don't agree with, and I'm not necessarily accusing Lynn of this, but the market overall seems to be suffering from what I call the recency bias in this inflation debate. The point is that if we look at inflation, I think we've had a level shift. But from a cyclical perspective, I'm not sure that I want to place all of my chips on inflation increasing from today and over the next 6 to 9 months. And that's an important distinction to make.
Yeah. Well, obviously, it mostly depends from supply chain disruption. At this stage, we have had some broadening pressures on inflation. If you look at the basket and where the changes in US inflation have been from 2019 to 2022, the changes are still mostly related to supply bottlenecks, but they're now broadening a bit towards goods and other more sticky parts of the inflation basket. This broadening actually depends on demand. And if demand isn't strong, then cyclically strong and incrementally strong, it's very difficult for inflationary pressures to broaden. They can remain sticky in certain baskets, but they're not going to broaden. And also, truth to be said, when you go and put on trades, you also have to look at what markets are pricing against your base case. And one-year inflation swaps and two-year inflation swaps in the US are still very elevated, to the tune of 5%. Last time I checked, was around about 5% or more, actually. So you are already, to a certain extent, pricing in some sticky components of inflation to remain high from that perspective. So it's not like you're breaking new grounds by assuming that inflation will keep on being high. Again, as Jim said last week, a crowded trade is not a wrong trade by definition. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition to make it a bad trade. So we're just going to own for now the Brazilian real here long as an expression of that theme, not pile up with another highly correlated trade, although we respect Lynn's macro take and presentation. I would say that is it for this episode. Recap, the trade that Lynn Alden put out is to be long AMLP ETF, which is effectively an energy infrastructure, oil and gas mostly infrastructure ETF, that gives you exposure to these energy pipeline companies. She entered it today. It's the 20th of April, 2022. And the live trade from Jim is to be long Brazilian real against the dollar, which was put on in the inaugural episode of the Macro Trading Floor. Andreas, shall we say goodbye to our listeners for this episode?
Yes. And finally, I want to remind you that if you want to support our growth, please rate our podcast in the various podcast apps. We should be live on all podcast apps now. We fixed the issue with Google. So thanks again for listening to us. We are so proud of the feedback that we've received over the first week. Thanks for the support. My name is Andreas Stino, and thanks for this week.
And bye from Alfonso Peccatillo as well. Talk to you next week, guys, on the Macro Trading Floor. Ciao.